Okay, it might be the case that we're not going to need all of the 2 hours this afternoon. We'll see how far we get. It's the second in the research design sessions that we're looking at over the course of this part of term. And hopefully this is another session in which you can begin to explore in front of the rest of the class and in front of me some of the important internal dimensions of your proposed PhD thesis. And I can begin to try to convince you that you already have plausible strategies for being able to narrate some of the most important elements and propositions related to your PhD. Last time we looked at contributions to the literature. This week we're going to look at something which is related, but certainly not a direct overlap. We're going to look at how you might construct a single underlying research question. So not a series of reflections on the types of things I find useful and interesting relative to my topic, but the single underlying research question which will be reflected all of the way through the PhD and will lend some sort of structural coherence to the PhD itself. One of the difficulties, if you're in your PhD viva, is sitting there, you've answered the first question about your contributions to the literature, you feel as though you're getting into the swing of the PhD viva, you're still a little bit nervous, but you think that you're going to be able to cope with those nerves. And then suddenly, your external examiner sits back in his or her chair, looks upwards at the ceiling, looks back down at you and says, well, that's all very well and good, but I couldn't tell what your underlying research question was. It looked to me as though you moved sequentially between one underlying research question and another one. And by the time I reached the end of your PhD, I didn't quite know which PhD it was that you were trying to write. Lots and lots of PhD students in the past have been faced with that sort of question stroke challenge. Hopefully none here, because we get the chance to talk about the importance of having that single underlying research question. But PhD students as a whole, if you lined them all up and got them to reflect back to you what happened at their PhD viva, a significant proportion will tell you that they were accused, because it often comes across as an accusation, that they were accused of not having a single underlying research question. Because the really big accusation that underpins that observation is that your PhD does not follow the same path from start to finish. That it's organised around some issues at the start, and it's organised around different issues at the end. And the question becomes, how do I know that you've contributed to knowledge if I can't tell in which specific area that knowledge contribution is made, because you seem to move between one underlying research question and another? It's about tangents in many ways, and the necessity of eliminating all potential tangents from your own work. Now, there are very, very good reasons that come from the practicalities of writing a PhD why you might have this, drift in focus over an elongated period of time. And that's because you write your PhD over 4 years. And if you're sequentially drafting chapters one after another, the first chapter might be written in draft form anyway at least 3 years before the final chapter. And in those 3 years, imagine just how many people you've listened to telling you what's important and what's at the cutting edge of the literature, just how many pieces of work you've read telling you exactly the same, just how many times in your own mind you've reinvented what your own research is about. And it can be very well reflected in a drift between one focal point and another over time. It might just be a case of your ideas maturing, but it might also be a case that you've shifted focus from one underlying research question to another. Now, evidence of your work maturing is a good thing, and that's one of the benefits of writing a PhD over a 3 or 4 year period. It means that you don't have to stay with your initial approach to the subject matter. It means that you are able to innovate, to see what works with your argument, to try to introduce new elements of originality into it. That's what a PhD is about, after all. But it does mean that you have to guard against accidentally allowing your focus to drift from one underlying research question to another. It might mean, of course, that over the whole of the programme, you change your mind as to what that underlying research question is. And there is nothing wrong with that at all. As long as, once you've come to a definitive decision about what that question will be, you subsequently redraft all of the previous chapters so that it reflects your new understanding of what your underlying research question is. So the underlying research question should be that thing that lends coherence to the whole of your PhD when it's read as one single piece of work. You will not write it as one single piece of work. Nobody ever starts off on one Monday morning with no words on the page and just sits there in front of the computer until they've finished and hands it in. But that's the way in which your examiners will read your PhD. They will read it as a single integrated piece of work, however you put it together, and you want to give them the impression that that is what they're reading by having this consistent thread that runs all the way through it. And it's your research question that creates that thread. The research question itself should appear in one form or another in every chapter introduction. It should also appear in every chapter conclusion. So you introduce each of your PhD chapters in relation to how much progress you've already made in the course of the PhD towards answering your underlying research question, formulating the strategy for the current chapter on the basis of what you now need to do to take the next decisive steps to being able to answer that underlying question fully and effectively. Equally, I think it's a good strategy to write the conclusions of each PhD thesis chapter almost on the basis of a checklist of how far you've now come in this overall trajectory of leading the reader all the way through to your final answer to your underlying research question. So the underlying research question is maybe something that should be written on a post-it note and stuck on your computer screen. So every time you're writing anything on your PhD, you write it with that, if not visibly in front of you, but at least somewhere where you can always go back to check it. So it always becomes at the forefront of your mind. It is that important to have something that defines the core of the PhD. We've spoken about this before, that every topic provides the possibility of writing endless numbers of PhDs. And it's about finding the one single PhD that you want to construct from your topic. And my advice is always to use the underlying research question as a means of, I guess, placing parameters around the literature, telling you what is the important stuff to be reading, what is the important stuff to be writing on. So what might your research question look like? It could be constructed in any type of way. It could be a primarily theoretical research question. It could be a primarily empirical research question. I think it's probably most usual for people to start off with an empirically oriented research question, but the way in which they flesh that out in their PhD introduction is to show how that empirically oriented research question actually has important implications theoretically for the literature with which they're engaging. Could be, however, that you choose to write a PhD, which in some sense is the other way round, that the theoretical research question is the important thing, but the theoretical research question implies a particular type of empirical focus, which you then explain in your PhD introduction when you're saying what your underlying research question actually is. Another reason that it's important to be able to, I guess, finalise in your own mind what your underlying research question is that it has important implications for the type of methodology that you adopt. Certain research questions almost inevitably apply the adoption of quantitatively based research methods. Certain research questions almost inevitably imply the adoption of qualitatively based research methods. If, for example, your research question is one about attitudes, looking at a governing party's attitude towards a particular policy, then clearly the methodology is both going to be archive-based, looking at the development of policy in a particular area over a particular period of time, but it's also likely to be interview-based. You can only tell so much about attitudes from looking at the way that policies are written in black and white on paper. It might also be necessary to go to talk to the policymakers to try to get behind the process of policy making to see what was influencing their thinking at the time. It could be that you're looking for general tendencies within, I don't know, within the world economy, whether that's the relationship between trade and development, something along those lines, at which stage it would be likely that you would choose a big end sample, so a large number of countries, and you would try to manipulate some statistical data to tell you what that relationship is between trade and development within a particular period of time. So the research question there implies a distinct methodological approach. And the distinct methodological approaches in the two examples I've given you could hardly be more different, but both are logically implied by the underlying research question on which they focus. So that's why it's important, or another reason why it's important, to get your underlying research question clear in your own mind and also right in your own mind, because it does imply a particular methodological perspective. PhD examiners will often ask you rather more questions about your methodology than you were expecting before you go into the PhD fiver. And they will do this to try to understand more about your research design. They will do this in particular to try to convince themselves that you have a methodological basis for your PhD which matches the intentions that are announced in your underlying research question. If your examiners identify some sort of a mismatch between the two, they won't necessarily withhold the award of the PhD, but they are likely to ask you some rather uncomfortable questions about why you chose to use a methodology that doesn't seem to fit the research question. Or alternatively, why have you asked your research question in a way that doesn't fit the methodology? Both of those would seem to be not a cardinal sin, but a problem, the sort of problem that PhD examiners often pick up on. They want to be impressed not only with the detail of the explanation that you deliver within your PhD, but they want to be impressed by the way that you put your PhD together. A PhD that's well structured will actually cover up a multitude of sins in the actual writing. So it's very much in your interests to have thought clearly about this issue. So research questions take you from the broad topic to the way in which you define a particular angle, a particular perspective on that topic. One of the things that will probably happen, I'm sure this will be the case, when we go around the table and I ask you about your underlying research question, is that you will tell me probably three or four different ones. And that's understandable at this stage of your PhD. You're still in the position of trying to work out in your own mind exactly which direction you're going in. But it becomes a useful exercise, I think, to start having these discussions about your own work in public, in front of all of your classmates, in front of me as well. Because it will give you, bless you, it will give you a much greater sense of what it is exactly that you're trying to do, the more that you're required to talk about your underlying research question.
I think it's quite important to make clear the relationship between the underlying research question, which is a single one, and I'm sure everyone here in the room will also probably have few sub-questions in their PhD work. So I'm just wondering, how can I define the relationship between the main research question and the sub-questions?
I think that's an excellent point, and I'm sure that that is the position that everyone will find themselves in at the moment, that they will have perhaps still only a provisional idea of what the main question is, but might be more interested by some of the sub-questions than the main question. And that's one of the things over the next few weeks, over the next few months even, that I would advise you to concentrate on, to work out exactly what the most important question is that underpins your thesis. Because it will be the case when you write your thesis introduction and you begin to focus on your underlying research question, it will be the case that the question itself will naturally infer other questions, other lines of exploration that you're able to engage in. So I think you should see it very much as a single underlying research question that then has other implications for the type of analysis that you will undertake. And those other implications can be thought of and can be addressed as sub-questions. You ask another important point, though, which is how can you tell the difference between what's your main one and what the sub-questions are? I'm not sure there's any generic answer to that. I think that what you have to do is to hold all of those possible varieties of questions and sub-questions in mind for now. And one of the steps that you will need to go through between now and the first year review process is to get that clear in your own mind. If there is a generic answer, then it will follow from asking yourself which one of those questions logically implies all of the rest. So if there is one that you have to ask first to make all the others make sense, then that will be your main underlying research question. That will be your single underlying research question, and everything else will be a sub-question that flows from it. So that's maybe the only generic answer I can give you. The test of your own questions are whether they are inferred by other questions or whether they do the inferring. If you find that one of your questions does the inferring of all the other questions, then you've found your single underlying research question. That sounded clear in my mind, but probably not the way that I said it. Do you get what I'm driving at there? Does that make sense? Are there any other questions on these broad issues for a start? What about the content of an underlying research question? How straightforward can it be? Could it be one that's simply answered yes or no? I think it can. I think lots of empirically oriented underlying research questions could in principle be answered simply yes or no. Obviously, to write a PhD around an underlying research question that can be answered yes or no, the strength of the PhD will be on how well you demonstrate that the answer is simply yes or no, rather than giving a straightforward answer like that and just leaving it at that. So what you're going to have to do there is to make sure that you have an explanatory framework that's capable of making sense of a really straightforward answer to a straightforward question. But in principle, there's nothing wrong with asking a question that is as straightforward as a yes-no type question. Of course, many PhDs are written to test propositions that emerge from reading more theoretically based literature. And if they are written to test a proposition that emerges from a broader theoretical literature, actually it's quite likely that it will take the form where in principle it can be answered yes or no. Does the inference from the literature stand up to empirical scrutiny? That is a yes-no question. So just because a PhD itself is a complex piece of work which takes you into complicated territory, it doesn't mean that the underlying research question has to be complex just for the sake of it. It might even be a mistake to make your underlying research question sound too complicated. What might an examiner say if they're faced on page one or page two or whatever it is of a PhD with an intricately worded but deeply, deeply complex underlying research question? I think most examiners would immediately get some sort of doubt in their mind, and they would think, well, that's all very well and good, but how on earth are you going to do it? How on earth are you going to set up a research design which allows you to answer that sort of question effectively? So you need to be able to give a sense to your examiners through the way that you articulate your underlying research question, not only that you have a single PhD that you are trying to write here, but that that PhD can be written in the first place, that it becomes doable. Imagine all the possible sets of undoable PhDs that are out there. And PhDs in general are undoable for one of two reasons. Either, firstly, they just try to do too much. The ambition is always laudable in academic work, but the ambition simply cannot be satisfied within the word count that you have. And the second reason that PhDs become undoable is if they imply a methodology which cannot be feasibly constructed. For instance, if you are writing a PhD on something along the lines of elite opinion in South Korea on South Korean foreign policy, and you have a particular president whose policy you want to study, does this mean that the only feasible research methodology involves you having access to the president and interviewing the president and being able to present the president's views on that particular policy? Might not be entirely the only way that you could do it, but you might worry a PhD examiner that what's inferred by the way that you ask your research question is that you really should have had access to this particular person. And one thing that we know of presidents of all political persuasions in all countries is that they tend to be really quite busy on a day-to-day basis. And so if you ever manage to send an email to whatever personal assistant sits in the office before their other 16 personal assistants before you get anywhere near the president, even if that first person opens the email, it is unlikely that it will go all the way to the president and the president will say, yeah, of course, a week on Tuesday, got nothing on in the afternoon, come and see me, we'll have a chat. So it could be that accidentally, in the way that you ask your research question, you present yourself with a PhD that in methodological terms is so difficult to do that your examiner's immediate reaction is that it's probably undoable. Writing PhDs which involve accessing public opinion are very, very tricky as well. How do you get at public opinion? It's not quite like just going down the pub and talking to your mates. What do we think about policy X? To make big claims that you have access to public opinion, you're going to have to unlock public opinion in ways which have always proved to be very, very difficult for anything other than the most highly resourced research units. So you must be careful, in other words, about the way in which you present your underlying research question. It isn't simply ambition for ambition's sake here. It's about sending a message to your PhD examiners that you've thought clearly about what the limits of PhD research are and how you're working within those limits, but still able to show ambition, even though there are some PhDs which are just out of bounds. So please don't write your underlying research questions in a way to imply a PhD which, on the grounds just of doability, are out of bounds. Any other questions from anyone? Because it might be that this is one of those issues which it's difficult to talk about in general terms, but as soon as we open it up and people begin to talk about their underlying research question, that we might be able to get a better sense of some of the pitfalls to avoid and some of the advice that should be taken. Okay, so why don't we do that? So if you can tell me, just in a couple of minutes, what you believe your underlying research question is, how this might involve a particular type of research design built on a particular research methodology, what the dangers of pinning all your hopes to that particular methodology might be. That's one just off the top of your head. And also how your underlying research question opens out into a series of maybe discrete sub-questions. Which sounds like more of an exercise than I actually told you I was trying to set you last week. But you see the way that my mind is working when I ask you not just the one question in isolation, but the four questions together. Because it might mean that you have to be aware of all those four things at the same time whenever you're thinking about your underlying research question. So let me just repeat them, and I'll probably make a note so I remember myself what they are. There's the research question itself, and I'm more than happy if you just tell me about that. There's also the way that the research question opens out into a series of discrete sub-questions. Because it might be those sub-questions, for instance, that become the focal points for the individual chapters. And the more that you begin to become comfortable thinking about not only your research question but its implications for sub-questions, the more you might provide yourself with insights as to what should go into individual chapters. Now, we haven't got anywhere near discussing that yet, but that's also another big hurdle on the way to writing most PhDs. Some PhDs have a much more intuitive chapter structure than others. So, for instance, if you're doing a four-country comparison on policy X, you know for a start that you're going to have at least four empirical chapters, one on each country, on policy X. And so that's at least half of your PhD written, or if not written, that's half of the PhD structure written. But other PhDs could evolve in different ways, and maybe allowing those sub-questions themselves, the most logically inferred sub-questions from your underlying research question, to set the agenda for the individual chapters is a sensible way of doing it. So those are the first two things. The third thing was the implied methodology. How your research question almost forces you to focus on a particular type of methodologically based study. And the related one there, the pitfalls about applying potential methodologies. I'll let you into a secret. One of the favourite questions at first year review time, if the panel can't think of anything else to say, they will always ask you foolproof question about methodology. They will look at what the implied methodology is and they will say, but what's your plan B? What happens if for some reason those policy documents that you are absolutely convinced you will have open access to and will study in great detail What happens if they're not on open access? That there's some sort of moratorium on their publication? What happens if you pin all your hopes on interviewing certain figures? What happens if you don't get access to them? Most people say no when asked to be the interviewee in an academic situation. Most people say no to even the most famous professors. Some people are born egotists and think that the world becomes a better place the more that their opinion is reflected in anybody's work, and therefore they will say yes and they will talk to absolutely anyone. These are the people that wander around bus stops hassling people to listen to them and their wonderful ideas. But most people will say no. So a question that often gets asked at first year review time is about a plan B. Have you formulated a plan B which allows you still to conduct the PhD if your first choice methodological approach somehow fails to come to fruition? Because believe me, it can be a deeply, deeply unsettling experience. You're, I don't know, 18 months into your PhD, you've got 2 or 3 good explanatory chapters already drafted. You know in your own mind exactly what your PhD is going to be. You set off on field work. You're off to collect all the information that you need then to write the empirical chapters. You're making such good progress, you're absolutely sure that you're going to have everything handed in on time within 3 years. And then your field work is a bit of a disaster. All of those things you thought that you were going to find out, you either haven't even had access to the people to tell you about them, or you find that it's classified information that you're not allowed to access. What do you do then? That's a deeply unsettling experience for any PhD student. Because the instinct is always to say, well, if I can't do that PhD, I've got to start again. I've got to go all the way back to the beginning and literally start from scratch. And that's not a comforting thought for anyone, which is why we often ask you about plan Bs at the first year review process, and why it's also sensible, even at this stage, to be thinking what your underlying research question implies about your methodology, and also whether it allows you acceptable and adequate plan Bs, just in case things go wrong with your first choice data collection. Okay? Who wants to start by telling me about their research question?
I can start.
Go on.
I didn't match it all, but I can therefore start. I think it will be quick. You said that we probably have several options, so I wrote down a couple after doing some thinking. And I wrote one, which is, I feel it's a bit long, but how successful is the EU principle of coherence within trade agreements with regions in the south? And then the second that I wrote was, do the EU trade agreements with regions in the south promote sustainable development? So that's
okay.
Sort of like yes-no question, I think, that you were talking about. And the first one is like focusing more on the issue of coherence.
It's quite usual within our subject field to find research questions starting with a phrase like how successful. What would you have to do with a research question like that? Are there any qualifications that you have to make to that?
I guess you would have to make up some criteria of what success in that field means. Like what do you define as success and why? And that would be like quite ideological.
Yeah, I think it implies a fair bit of pressure on your explanatory framework. Firstly, to be able to devise a series of criteria, but also to recognise that those criteria are going to be inherently contested, and to be able to show the full range of, possible answers to the question before you begin to develop the explanatory framework that will lead you to your particular answer. So that's the sort of underlying research question that I think has implications for the literature review as well. Mm-hmm. That it begins to suggest that the literature review itself will be organised around being able to identify and define a series of criteria against which it might be possible to judge success. So it begins to show you a way of writing the literature review, as well as it might show you a way of beginning to organise the subsequent chapters as well. So research questions that begin how successful, I think, have an obvious appeal because they tell each of us a lot about the type of PhD that's likely to be written along these lines. So it was probably just good fortune on our behalf that Johanna went first, and the first two words she said were how successful, because that is a fairly standard underlying research question for a politics PhD. But it does, as she rightly says, it does then open up so much of the question to the underlying political principles that you want to bring into your explanatory framework.
Yeah, because all are like contested concepts, like development and development for whom. And, I mean, there's no like one answer to it, so it's just going to depend on mm-hmm. how you view things and what you value. And yeah.
Which are maybe a number of the sub-questions that then have to be asked about or in relation to this particular policy.
Mm-hmm.
So how the policies embed a particular value structure and which alternative value structures might be excluded because of the way that the policy works. What about implied methodology? What do we think as a group the implied methodology is for Jan? Because you're studying a policy, but I would suggest it's unlikely to be a conventional policy studies PhD.
Yeah, I'd hope so, because that's not what I want to do.
Because a conventional policy studies PhD is simply to find all the documents, review all the documents, pick out the important issues as you see them that emerge from the documents, and try to back those maybe with further archival data or further interview data.
Mm-hmm.
Does that come as being what Johanna has in mind here? I'm not sure. I would imagine that your PhD is probably looking more at questioning inbuilt assumptions about particular criteria of how to judge success
mm-hmm.
than it might be about defining a particular criteria and then trying to judge the success against that. So a more critically minded PhD.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I find the whole issue of development and like development for whom, that's what I find interesting to begin with. And then when you relate it to gender and to trade, like, there's nothing about gender in the question, but that would certainly be one of my criteria for development.
Any ideas yourself on methodology at this stage? Just general reflections on what you might actually do to write a PhD along those lines that answers that question.
Well, obviously analysing the EU's own definitions of development, because there are debates going on within the EU about coherence, and it's also like related to the Lisbon Treaty and more power to the Parliament, to the EU Parliament, and there's definitely a discussion going on about making like all the different areas of politics more coherent, such as trade and competitiveness and development of
So there's a formal commitment to what might be called joined up government, making sure that all of those policy areas cohere in some sense. There might also be groups of policy activists that you're able to, if not embed yourself within, but at least work closely in relation to. Are there women's groups working on actively lobbying on around these issues?
Yeah, I think there are think tanks and more sort of activist type groups.
Which will be important to work closely alongside. And of course, one of the benefits there is that advocacy groups of that nature are often much more willing to become research subjects in PhD work than elite figures, politicians, people like that, because they will think that this is likely to be, even at the academic level, some positive positive reinforcement for the type of work that they're doing. And it might be that you find that you have much greater access working with advocacy groups than with more traditionally minded actors in the policy domain. Okay, good. Thank you very much. One down, 11 to go. Who wants to go next? By just telling me, Simona, briefly about research question, then we'll try to unpack some of the other issues.
Okay, so first of all, I have different questions, but I think that the best one I've come up with so far is whether diversified production and brand unity can lead to the depoliticization of military firms.
Can you repeat that?
Can diversified production and brand unity, I mean, it is implicitly assumed that it's between military and civilian products, lead to the depoliticization of military firms? That's the question. And because I think that, of course, there are other questions. First, I came up with the question, how does the depoliticization of military firms occur? But actually, it is wrong, because I would assume that this one necessarily. And I think this would be one of my sub-questions, because I think that there is one going on.
Although there's nothing wrong, generically, with taking the bolder approach of writing a research question that already assumes that a particular process is in play. Nothing wrong with that at all, because remember what I was saying back before Reading Week, that you're judged against the criteria that you define yourself for your PhD. Yeah, so as long as you have set a research design which allows you to work with that assumption and to work with that assumption profitably, to shed light on the effects that it implies, then that is absolutely fine. So you don't have to have, in some sense, a neutrally worded question that does not already allow you to take a decisive position in relation to the question itself. It's probably more the case that most people will take a decisive position in relation to the question itself.
I mean, instinctively, that's what I would do. That's where I came up with that first. And then I thought, well, maybe it's not okay. But
I would see absolutely no problem with that. The starting off with a bold assertion about the nature of modern corporate life, that in itself then becomes a series of assumptions that are able to be demonstrated and demonstrated through developing an explanatory framework that matches. The whole depoliticisation issue is a really interesting one in this respect, though. Because how do you demonstrate depoliticisation? Because demonstrating that something doesn't happen is often at least as important, if not more important, in politics terms than demonstrating that something does happen. But being able to account for something that doesn't happen, I think, is intrinsically more important than being able to account for something that does happen. mainly because if there are competing explanations for why something has happened, there are going to be many more competing explanations for why something hasn't happened.
Yeah.
But again, I don't see there's a problem with that. I would be really surprised if by the end of your programme, the majority of you were not trying to account, at least implicitly, for something that hasn't happened, as opposed to something that has.
I think that the point with that is that my starting point is that this kind of firms that diversify production and keep the same brand seems quite counterintuitive to me. So that's my starting point. Because usually, because there are many people that are concerned with buying products that are explicitly linked to the military industry, or so that's why it was strange when I first noticed that, and this is where my starting point is. So
because you would expect, wouldn't you, that the
easy try to keep it separate and actually convert, you know, that they won't show it to the world. So I guess that's why I'm interested in depoliticization, because I want to see if, I think it is one of the reasons that allows them to do it. Or one of the,
In whose eyes does depoliticization take place? Is it depoliticized as a conscious strategy of the producer, or is it simply depoliticized because most consumers don't notice?
I think it's a strategy. Because they do it in such a way on their websites, and that it's almost shocking the way in which it is done. So I think there is a strategy behind it.
I asked a loaded question there. Did the rest of you spot that I'd asked a loaded question? Now that I asked that question, assuming that it would almost push Simona to answering that it's a deliberate strategy, what am I going to ask about implied methodology?
Is anybody going to admit to that?
Of course, no. Ideally, it would be great to call them and say, hi, is it? Did you do it on purpose or not? But this is not going to happen. I mean, I will try. You know what I mean? But I don't think this is going to happen. So I think I will have to focus a lot on the language that they use and try to see where this can lead.
But yeah, because gaining access to them at any level other than what they willingly publish in the public domain is likely to be quite difficult, because corporate actors are often almost quite reclusive when it comes to making themselves available for research purposes.
I think it really depends on what their perception of what you're going to do is too. And
yes.
It really depends on how you sell yourself to them and what your project is. Because if they're likely to think it's going to be something that's quite positive, I think they're much more likely to see you.
Try to manipulate it.
That's what I've been doing for my master thesis with like corporate people in Guatemala. I've been like interviewing really elite type people and having them probably think that it's all positive, the things I'm writing, but then it's actually quite critical. But
yeah, this is something that we'll come to more in 2 weeks' time when we talk about interviewing, but is it necessary at times to almost adopt a deliberate role that hides what you're actually trying to do?
So you don't have to lie. I think it's more about higher
percentage,
no?
Hmm. Yeah, this.
I had some problem to do it, like you did it in your master. Well, it's not like a lie. It's more like you have a very different view on the world than they do.
Well, but what about the justification of your strategy towards them? Right? You have to think about it.
Yeah, I know, right? But you don't care, you know? This is the problem.
But if you're too open, you might very well come across them, or Simona, I'm sure, would do with the nature of her research, would come across as some sort of implicit threat, because the research is critique. But then if you're not entirely honest about it, are you suckering them in to tell you things that they wouldn't have told you if you had have been entirely honest about them? And then there are ethical issues about the conduct of the research.
Maybe legal issues.
And maybe possibly legal issues as well, given that given that PhD we'll have a goodbye party for Simona before she goes and does her fieldwork, just in case she doesn't come back.
I just want to send a robot over.
Yeah, if we see you racing down the road followed by loads of robots, we'll know what's going on there. But there are these important issues. We will deal with this more when we look at interviewing, but to do the sort of PhD that Simona wants to write, it's likely that she's going to be faced with access difficulties, that there will be a lot of information that the company themselves puts in the public domain, but presumably that information, given that it's been voluntarily put in the public domain by them, will, from your perspective, be whitewashed information that doesn't tell you exactly what you need to know. It's the polished PR account rather than the nitty-gritty of what's actually going on. And that's really difficult in PhD research, sometimes to get past the barriers of the way in which whether it's individuals working within government who have always got a story to tell that always, funnily enough, makes them look right all the time, or whether it's a corporation that wants to do nothing to jeopardise its ability to make money out of its products, everyone's got you a whitewashed story to tell. And that can be really, really tough when writing PhDs on that too. To chip away at that public facade. If your PhD is all about looking behind that facade, how do you actually render anything visible so you can see it? Not easy. Not easy.
I know. I already noticed that while I've spent so much time on the website. And
so they probably logged you as some sort of corporate stalker. Yeah.
They already, as I said, probably last time, they already don't mention some of their partnerships.
Mm.
And then with with firms producing proper weapons, because they produce only platforms that can be used for these weapons, which they don't say, which is the thing they don't say.
Mm.
So and on the other company's website, they are mentioned as their partners. So I think it's going to be a lot of guesses.
Yeah, and probably a lot of frustration as well, that you will be able to put lots of hours in. But it's one of those areas where the silences are the fascinating elements, and it's about being able to uncover those silences in a way that becomes meaningful to the research. So it's not easy. And if Simona does come up to anyone and say, can I just borrow your laptop for a couple of minutes? You know that she wants to log on to that website again, but with somebody else's account, rather than her own. Great stuff. Thank you. Thank you. Because there's both of those, there have been, a number of general implications which are likely to be useful for other people as well. Who wants to go next?
My main research question will be how does NGO accountability operate as a practice of global governmentality? And my sub-question will be, of course, first of all, to clear what I mean by global governmentality.
Sure.
As a conception of world order, of course. And then I will try to analyze prevailing or hegemonic concepts of accountability, and then try to show the conditions under which these accountability discourses are taking place, and then showing the consequences for of these discourses for
Hello.
Sorry, I was confused. I thought you had 2 o'clock.
No.
Yeah.
It's always one when we meet on Tuesdays. It was just that first Monday.
Yeah.
Because of me being away before that. Sorry.
So I will try to share the consequences of these accountability discourses for global governmentality. And then lastly, I try to show the dynamics using case studies. At the moment, I'm considering to take NGO accountability charter, the One World Trust, and Action Aid accountability and planning system as my case studies. And the methodology I will try to apply consists, of course, of two sets. First of all, I try to gather this kind of information by doing mainly library-based research, document analysis. Of course, I try to gain access to, for example, World Trust and other major NGOs to do my interviews. And what I also want to do is first-hand observation, being part of meetings,
okay,
for example, just to see how they communicate, how it works, to make some kind of observations. So it's my methods of gathering information. And the other step is, of course, thinking about how I want to interpret these informations. And my main focus will be, of course, on discourse analysis and in the construction of this discourse analysis. And, of course, I would also try to do a kind of reconstruction to offer, I wouldn't say a new concept of accountability, but at least to try to address the objections which I gained from my deconstruction and try to begin, bring it together.
Great stuff, thank you. So an important element of the research design is going to involve some degree of participant observation.
Exactly, yeah.
So, everyone, being a predictable person, I don't have many questions. I always try to ask the same questions all the time. What am I now going to ask Manija on that basis? What are the issues there?
Access.
Yeah, access. Do you know, have you already got a strategy in place that might get you access to meetings of this nature?
No, yeah. For example, I knew that the NGO accountability organizations who created it will meet every year in different places all over the world. Last year was, I think, in Turkey. I thought UK will be a quite interesting occasion to go there, but I don't know if they want me, of course.
Well, I think all that I need to say there for now is that if you are able to deliver that style of participant observation research, that will be a huge bonus for the PhD that you're trying to write. But the PhD is eminently writable even if you can't do that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So it's not a make or break situation whether you can get that degree of access.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that you're going to have to work very hard to get it, but I also think it's worth putting in the effort to see whether you can negotiate that access for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can, and if you are able to observe firsthand the way that, not only the way that decisions are made, but the way that positions are articulated in an attempt to reach some sort of decision, then that will be very important for the research that you do.
Yeah, but it will not be my main element.
No.
So it's actually library-based research,
sure,
document analysis, and I'm lucky enough to get access to people doing my interviews. The observation is actually number 4.
Yeah, it's not the priority, but it would be... What's the analogy? The analogy is about... it's not the whole cake, but it's the icing on top of the cake,
mm-hmm,
isn't it? So it would make the rest of the research even more compelling. Okay, nobody liked that analogy. I have another question, and I'm going to ask everyone else again and not Manija, because she asked the question, how do you know the difference between your single underlying research question and the sub-questions which are attached to it? And I suggested that the answer was if you can spot one question which infers all the others, then that is your single underlying research question. Do we think that she got them in the right order?
I don't remember all of them.
I mean, I can repeat it. My main research question is in geo-accountability as a practice of global governmentality, how does it work or how does it operate? And then my first sub-question is what global governmentality means as a world order, and then showing prevailing or Germanic concepts of accountability, showing the conditions and the consequences and the dynamics. So.
Right way round? Right order? Yeah, I think so too. And you know why I thought it was going to be like that even before I'd heard them all the first time around? Those first two words that Manija used to describe her underlying research question, how does? The first two words of underlying research questions are often the most important, because that's what gives you the character of the question that's being asked. And a how does question is almost always going to be the right sort to ask for an underlying research question. This is an underlying research question that will have the practical focus that's a really important part of your PhD work, and it will also have the empirical orientation logically implied by the way that the question is asked. So that's what I said right at the beginning about the chance that lots of your underlying research questions will have the empirical focus built into them, and Manija's did that. And in general, I think questions that begin how does, they imply a practice that can be studied empirically, and once you've understood the concrete dynamics of the empirical case, then you begin to understand the theoretical implications of that. So I think you've got those spot on, absolutely the right way round. Well done.
Just like
shh, don't tell me that, and don't tell the tape that either. We're doing underlying research questions today. So there's about 40 minutes of me speaking on the tape for a start, which you'll be able to find from the website. I'll upload it again, or I'll get Daz to upload it onto my podcast page. So you'll be able to catch that up. And now we're just going around. People are talking through their research questions, and we're just seeing what lies beneath them and whether they're thinking in the right direction. Who's next? Sumi. Sorry, you had your hand up before. I should have come straight to you.
I still have various kind of questions, and I can't put it in order. But currently I have kind of two main research underlying questions. One is, has the DAC, OECD Development Assistance Committee, has the DAC been effective in achieving its objectives? And my second underlying research question is, to what extent has the collective action in the DAC been successful? And under this, underlying research question, I have three sub-research questions, because when I say collective action, I think that I need to point out where the collective action hasn't been successful. And I thought that there are three points that I can make. One is where the just the collective action has not been made. And that's why I came up with this sub-research question, how can collective action among the DAC be possible? And I will probably look at the political economy of each donor as a member and point out what is the constraints for them to join the collective action. And my second sub-research question comes from the perspective that even though they are able to have the collective action, there might be a possibility that the scope of the collective action itself is too narrow. And that is why the collective action itself is not having a lot of impact on the what they are aiming for. I think of this because currently there are lots of policy has been made in the dark, but because China, India, the emerging countries are not members of the DAC. So even though they are doing good things, rightly what they decided, other external factors, which is outside of their scope, is really affecting or undermining their effort. So that is my second sub-research questions. And the third one is, even though they are able to have a collective action, if the objective of the original collective action, the original objective of the collective action was wrong, then they can have negative impact on the ground. So that's my three sub-research questions. And methodology, I don't know so much about all these research methodologies, but I will probably look at the documentation in the DAC.
Yeah.
Policy documentation and... because I'm going to take two case studies. One is a pair of case studies in the DAC where I can point out this is a successful collective action and this is unsuccessful collective action in the DAC, so that I can compare and probably contribute to the knowledge and theory of collective action. And my second case study will be based in developing countries because they are the ones who are receiving these policies that are taken in the DAC. So, yeah, from my second case studies, I will look at other aspects rather than their own internal work.
Well, that all seems to cohere very nicely together. By methodology, all I mean is strategies for data collection, how you're going to go about collecting your data. Now, Masu started with an underlying research question, the type of which we've already heard this afternoon. Whose underlying research question did it remind you of in generic type?
Her second one, the first one.
The first one, the underlying one.
Yeah, but she had two.
Well, the first one was about... I'm going to give the game away here. Was about... Sorry? Yes.
I was thinking mine, but...
Because it was how successful has the DAC been in meeting its own objectives, wasn't it?
To what extent has the collective action been successful?
Yeah. And because it's in relation to meeting its own objectives, then those objectives are formally a part of the public record. So it's then it's a little bit different to Johanna's, where defining the criteria about what might count as success and what doesn't would seem to be a more contested part of the record, at least in Masumi's case, if it's matching potential successes against the objectives of the DAC itself. Then you have a real clear guideline to start with as to how you're going to match up the practice with what the with what is implied by successes or not. Anyone anything to add there? Because it might very well be that it becomes easier to discuss these or quicker to discuss these as we go on, because we will find overlaps with generic questions that have already been asked.
I was thinking maybe it won't be so hard to do interviews with the top people, or like policy makers there either, because it's sort of in line with what they're actually trying to do. It's more like you're analyzing something that they are actually, like, you know, working on themselves how to do. It's not like in Simona's case, you know? It's quite easy. Well, I don't think you're going to have like a negative approach towards someone who's doing that sort of
evaluation?
It depends, and I don't know the answer here. It depends who speaks legitimately on behalf of the organisation, whether the organisation has its own internal secretariat, a range of what in other places would be seen as civil servants, who do the day-to-day policy work and who therefore can talk about whether the broader process has been successful or not, or whether success then gets defined by some of the there will be donor countries where they're involved in.
Well, officially the organization, international organization, is managed or it is consisted of the member countries.
Yeah.
The member countries are the one who can decide everything. But in reality, there are people who work within the international organizations, and they are. Some people say that they have much more power to lead the discussion and influence the.
So it has an autonomous internal structure at one stage removed from the member states, then? Yeah, they have latitude to on their day-to-day activities.
They do day-to-day activities, but in terms of decision-making structure, the member countries are the ones who can decide everything. But the officials within the working for the international organization, they also sit in a meeting and they direct, maybe underneath.
Because I asked those questions not only out of my own ignorance because I didn't know, but also because if there is a defined decision-making structure within the institution itself, almost like a permanent secretariat within the institution, then those people might very well be willing to give their time to allow you to use them as research subjects. If, however, the way that it operates, it's the delegates from member states who become the prime movers in the decision-making, it might be more difficult to get access to them.
Yeah, there is a permanent secretariat.
Yes.
In the organisation.
Okay. Do you have any links with them as yet?
Yeah.
Ah, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I won't.
Oh, okay. You see, I either didn't know that or I'd forgotten that. And either way, that means that it becomes much more likely that you can use your own personal connections to be able to.
But I think that depends on how I write my thesis. Mm-hmm. It has to be very constructive rather than just criticizing what they have been doing. So I think I need to put my thesis as a more forward-looking way. So that they will be also interested in joining and operating.
Sure, yeah. But when there are those personal connections that you can rely on, it is often the case that your requests for help from interviewees come across as being much less threatening to them. Much more likely that they will cooperate and say yes and give you their time. So if you do have connections like that, my advice is always to exploit them seriously. Blimey, it's 2:30 already. Who's next? We've only got through four. Benjamin.
Can we give it a try? So my, as I said last time, my research question is situated in the constructivist political economy literature, and within this field I'd like to ask the very general question, does economics perform the economy, or in other words, is the economy what the economists make of it? One could add a to what extent in front of the question, because obviously it's not pure performativity. So, several sub-questions follow quite straightforwardly, I think, from this general question. first is, how do economists construct governability? How do they make it governable? Then the second sub-question, how are models used, big macroeconomic models, used for policy making in central banks mainly? Because my focus will be on central banking. Then the third sub-question would be how is the model taught to the wider public by the central bank? Mm. And that's the three sub-questions. And in terms of methodology or data collection, the first and the second sub-question about governability and the use of models would suggest a very detailed study of New Keynesian, that's the paradigm, governability, just by like a close reading of recent literature or progress made in macroeconomics. And then the second aspect is would be to have interviews with central bankers. And within central banks, there's research staff and actual policymakers, and I would be very interested in doing interviews with both groups, mm-hmm. because it's the interaction in these two groups that would be interesting. And as I said last time, maybe also have interviews with private sector actors that are, in a way, the recipients of the communication. And obviously, pitfalls. What if they don't want to talk to me? That would be a problem. But it could still be done, I think.
Excellent stuff. That all seemed to cohere nicely to me. You must be well supervised, I think, is the conclusion that I can draw from that. Carlos, did you have a question there?
Is it geographically oriented in terms of countries?
I will probably focus either on the European Central Bank or the Federal Reserve Bank, maybe both.
But this is a more theoretically oriented research question, isn't it? Does economics perform the economy? But then it does have empirical implications. And I think it's nice the way that you start off with the big, broad theoretical question. And you show how that is a manageable question to ask because you have a definite strategy for how to move from the really abstract to the more concrete as you move through the chapters of your PhD.
Well, right, I presume that's the... If it's manageable...
Pardon?
It's a strategy. If it's manageable, I don't know.
It seems manageable to me. And you flagged up the obvious pitfalls that if you're hoping to be able to talk to some of these really senior level officials, access is always a problem, and anything that you can do to be creative in terms of thinking of plan B's between now and first year review time at least stops you getting taken by surprise when the obvious question gets asked at that stage. But given that we're running out of time and that seemed all very sensible to me, shall we move on for anyone else? Who else wants to tell me just then?
I can be quite quick. The question I've arrived at is, what is the role of consultancies in policy change in the international monetary system, and what are the implications for reform of the international financial architecture? I'll just highlight a few sub-areas that come into that rather than posing them as questions. The first one is looking at international organisations as bureaucracies, so getting into some sociological theories of bureaucracy coming in here. So from that point, I'll be looking at the logics of practice and the role of epistemic communities in policy change. From here, it moves into explaining the process of what's called norm entrepreneurship. So what is it about these policy networks of people that allows certain individuals to seize the policy agenda and install new norms. Underneath that, I'm using a linked ecologies framework to better explain this, and I won't go right into it, but this is something my supervisors Len Seabrook is pushing fairly well, and it fits in with my interests quite well, so they'll be raising questions that you can imagine around that. Finally, my personal critique that comes in is that I think the whole linked ecologies framework neglects human agency, what it is about the individuals themselves, where they rise up and seize control of the policy agenda. So a very key and obvious example is, what is it about John Maynard Keynes that allows him to seize the policy agenda and install new institutions for the whole world, basically? So, of course, the situation is right for him, but there must be something distinctive about him himself. Now, I believe that when you look at it in terms of professions, that consultancies coming in, there's a lot of expertise in consultancies that have ways to identify the human agency aspect. So that's the broad overview, and that's how it breaks down.
That's amazing that you've got this far already, because that was almost a chapter by chapter outline in brief, wasn't it, about what will appear all the way through the PhD.
Just got to do some reading.
And that wasn't exactly where you started in week one either,
no,
was it?
No, it's changed a bit, but it's fitting in well. I'm quite happy with it. So, yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. Anything about possible pitfalls here about the... How many of these consultancy groups are you going to need to be able to study in in-depth?
I'm not sure. Now that I've changed direction, I'm looking at the theoretical literature.
Yeah.
I'm going to spend up until April really getting my head around that, and then it's the following year to dive in. But I've worked for a management consultancy for 2 years. I'm still in touch with them. As well as some other people in London. So,
so that will help, yeah.
Yeah, I think that'll be fine.
You're already in a network for other purposes, and now it's about...
Finding the integration of everyone, so it suits everyone's interests, which, I don't know if advice or what, but I've been doing it for a few years. I find it, to get the interviews with people, it's really great just... to switch it, so you reframe everything in their interests, like you're saying, and with the synergy, it works well. But,
I'm really impressed with you all again. The fact that you're able to talk through your research questions quite so instinctively. I thought there would be much more rumming and erring and just throwing a few ideas out and seeing whether any of them took flight for now. But they do all seem to be linked to definite strategies for building PhDs up. Maybe you all think you've just been lucky so far this afternoon, but we'll see. I'm impressed. Well done. Who's next? Now that I've worried the people that are still to come by. You see, I never think before I open my mouth and start talking. Anyone else would like to have a go? Kieran. Kieran first, then Carlos.
It's quite quick. I want to look at, how do emotions and discourses of blame impact on conflict resolution attempts and on the success of conflict resolution attempts? So, sort of following on from that, then, how are these discourses of blame produced and performed? Methodologically, maybe sort of a critical discourse analysis of deconstructive readings of something, documents, news articles, speeches, and so on, which will hopefully expose some dynamics
that are quick. Well, the how do question works well. We've already been through that before, haven't we? It's a structuring device for the rest of the PhD. Do you need any methodological training or anything to be able to undertake critical discourse analysis of this nature? Have you had any before? I'm just thinking of one of our former PhD students, Jack Holland, who worked with a number of data packages that had the wonderful benefit of, you could put through thousands of news articles all at one go, and it would bring up or present to you different linguistic patterns and the prominence of particular types of articulatory form within the passages. And those are techniques that weren't available even 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So those sorts of issues could be very important to explore. And it might be for other people that are working on forms of discourse and looking at the way that discourse itself structures assumptions about what is possible and what isn't possible.
Is it some kind of software, or what's that exactly?
I'm absolutely sure it was. You're asking a person who struggles to remember how to switch his computer on from one day to the next. I'm not gifted technologically, and that's the kindest thing I can say about myself. But it will be possible if we have people, or a number of people, who are all interested in exploring these things.
I'm quite interested in it.
Yeah, to see whether we can get someone in to maybe run a training session.
Yeah.
Whether
it's possible.
Whether it's through the library, or we can ask Jack how he did it, and then allow him to tell us where you need to go to find these things.
Yeah.
But that could be very useful, because we do get quite a lot of people in the department working on discourse analysis themes and finding ways of operationalising that. It's much easier. Hold on, this might come out wrong. I was going to say it's much easier than it was even 5 years ago to do large level discourse tracking. Because there is software that will enable you to at least get the first dimensions of that presented to you. In my day, you just sat there in your room with newspaper clippings,
mm-hmm.
And you read through them all, and you were trying to pick out words and themes. And obviously, when you're doing it like that, your time is much more limited than the computer's time. The computer can get through so many more than you can.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there will be possibilities for that. Please do remind me about that, though, because that's almost as if I've made a promise to you that I don't know whether I'll be able to keep or not. But we can certainly do the exploring on your behalf and see whether that becomes possible, even if it means sending a few of you down to a training day somewhere else then.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure departmental budgets are not that tight, even in current circumstances, that we wouldn't be able to afford to do that. Okay, so thanks for that, Kieran. That's useful not only for your work, but it hopefully it presents opportunities for other people as well. Carlos, you were next.
Okay. So my question is, how does power ideational as well as material affect the formulation and implementation of policies related to poor people's sustainable access to safe drinking water in El Salvador from 2002 to present time? So I expect to also have some sub-research questions that will be mainly four. One would be the one that focuses on the social agent, another would focus on the social structure. The third one would be the relationship between agency related, so the agents and the social structure in terms of that link. So that would be the third relation. And the fourth would be, how do these relations affect the water cycle process? There's different dams of power that actually relate to that. So what I'll use, I'll definitely use critical discourse analysis as well. I will use partly statistical databases, because it's material as well, it's not only ideational. Interviews and participant observation and hidden observation as well. So just keep going. I think I did just as a P. In my master's thesis, I did use a bit of the software for critical discourse analysis, so I did use it for my master's thesis.
Oh, which software did you use?
So there was, I can't remember the name, because I sort of skimmed through the web and
got
lots.
Yeah.
And I sort of chose the easiest, because it was self-taught. But I might just, if you like, sort of share how it did. some of this, so if I can also join the people that are interested and maybe do a group on how to do critical discourse analysis, I think I would be really, really willing.
I think that'd be fantastic. I'll also email our library contact to see whether there's anything that the library run, because obviously the benefit of getting that from the library is firstly that they really should know what they're talking about, so it doesn't have to be self-taught, and secondly, with it being the library, we shouldn't have to pay for it. They should be able to deliver us those sessions because of the money that we give to the library every year as it is. So hopefully that will work. And Collis's underlying question was another how does question, wasn't it? So it fits the same sort of pattern as a number of the ones that we focused on previously. So I'm sure I don't need to say more about that, because all of your sub-questions seem to follow nicely from the underlying question. And they also point in the direction of the way in which individual chapters might be put together. And there does seem to be a strong element of critical discourse analysis around the table. So the more that we can do to provide generic training in that for everyone, the better, I think. Okay, brilliant, thank you. How many have we got left? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I think probably another 4. Sarah? I'll see how far we can get between now and 2:55 anyway. So maybe just another time for another couple.
I'll try to be quite quick then. I think at this point I've sort of narrowed my focus quite a bit to just dealing with the issues within the EU, so I wanted to look at why is there a significant disparity of geographical indications with between countries within the European Union, and whether or not this could be attributed to cultural differences, and potentially how does this affect their legitimacy being harmonized at the European level. So I made a list of all the countries, and I went on the official website and wrote down the numbers in each country, you know, and it's pretty clear, you know, that there's a huge imbalance basically within the European Union. So I didn't quite get to the methodology point yet because I sort of just discovered this like 3 days ago. So I was thinking mostly focusing on interviews, like most people, interviewing producers who have and have not certified their particular products, interviewing people within the established institutions. There was one study that was done that was focusing on, I think, 7 countries within the European Union, and sort of comparing the ones that have already established institutions, so France and Italy and that sort of thing, and comparing it with, like, for example, the Netherlands and the UK, which don't. And but theirs was mostly just sort of understanding the institutional differences, but I'm sort of wanting to do the cultural basis. So, and I think as far as my difficulties, definitely language, depending on which country I choose, because, you know, and there's so many countries within the Union to look at, you know, and so that could present a problem.
And language is one of those potential problems that's pretty much insurmountable, isn't it? You either can conduct interviews in a particular language or you can't. And there's very little you can do during the course of a PhD to bring yourself up from a position of not being able to do it to a position of being able to do it. So, that does have implications for the research design, but everything else that you spoke about there, Sarah, I think fits together very nicely. There was a why is question. I don't think we've had a why is before, but why is questions at one level are just another variant of the how does. It's asking the same sort of question but just in a different way. And the fact that your underlying research question started, why is there significant disparity? That produces an immediate comparative focus, and the comparative focus is something that will, I think, allow a fairly straightforward reading off of what individual chapters are likely to look like. So I think that all works extremely well. And I would suggest a clean bill of health there. So well done. one last one, possibly now, a couple?
I would like to start my underlying research questions in a broad way and hope to manage to narrow it down later. The question is why reforms are adopted and not adopted by the elites in Cambodia or developing countries in general. That is the research question I would like to look at, but after the literature reviews, I hope that I can narrow it down a bit. The reason that I use it in a broader sense because the answer to this question is economics. I mean, you can find tons of literature focusing on rational choice, the reasons explaining why the elites adopting some kinds of policies. So if we extend this analysis to include institutional settings and the cultural values that would include families and stuff, that would be the sub questions that we'll look at in addition to the economic reasonings. Because if we depend on the economic reasonings, then we may expect that there will be more Marxists in the world rather than less. Because, I mean, the dominant coalition will saturate at a certain point because there will be more and more people enter into the dominant coalition. But it seems to be so persistent that it has not happened. I mean, how this kind of thing is happening, because they also argue there's an absence of adaptive efficiency in the dominant coalition, but it happens to have these kind of things.
Hmm.
So what I would like to do, I mean, to extend the analysis from the economic reasoning to include more institutions and some cultural values, and maybe some of you may also know about the Asian values and the different views of Asia toward democracy. I mean, we don't see democracy as you see. I mean, our leaders also claim that we have a strong democracy compared to the U.S. Why you say we don't have to look? I would also look at that as well. That's what I want to do. And my research methodology may involve interview. And the big concern is that I may need to talk to politicians, and I do have some connections already. I hope to get some information from them, but there will be unified kinds of answers. I mean, they're not going to say, oh, this government is bad or something like that. That is one of the problems. And so I will also interview the opposition parties, but you may have a complete different pictures of governments.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to triangulate this by also interviewing the peoples in the international organizations and some donor country embassies, who are the major donors to Cambodia, like Japan.
Hmm.
I also need to collect some data as well, because I will test my theoretical with the policy introduced by the international organization, civil society, so questionnaires and some with the people to see how much they believe that there's progress or no progress in relation to the policies. How much, I mean, to what extent the objective of the policies are met, something like that. I'm not too sure yet, because it's quite early for me to make that decision.
Do you think it would be difficult to get access to these people?
The politicians?
Yeah.
I have built some connections already, so that I can get some of them, maybe not people at the top.
Yeah.
Because I'm also afraid that if I get the interview from them, then my dissertation will be closely looked as well, because we want to make sure that, you know, no words that they don't like are in my paper.
Mm.
But I also hope to interview the retired minister. I think they will be more open, because they're working with me at the university too.
Oh, okay,
so,
yeah.
So I think they're more willing to tell me a bit more about this kind of thing, and they used to live in the US and Europe, so they're more open than the army elites or people in the government.
And less likely that there will be pressure on the content of your findings as well, if you structure your interviews around retired rather than currently serving politicians. Yeah, I think that's very sensible, because here's a PhD, we spoke about this 2 weeks ago, didn't we? Here's a PhD that's going to be shaped in important ways by what is possible in terms of the information that you're likely to get, and also what is sensible in terms of making sure that you're able to write the PhD that you want to write without too overt a form of censure, and also what's sensible for you personally to make sure that nothing happens to put you in any sort of personal difficulty or danger. And these are live issues with lots of PhDs. Perhaps this is the only one here where those safety concerns are legitimate. But those safety concerns have to be taken seriously. And if that means making one or two compromises in your research design, well, of course, PhD examiners are going to accept that and they're going to understand why you've had to do that. Nobody is going to tell you that you've written the wrong PhD if the PhD that they think you should have written was one that might have put you in any sort of physical danger. It's another example of where PhDs are not always written exactly in the form that we would want to write them, and there are lots of good reasons why we might all have to make compromises from time to time between what a pristine research methodology might look like and what the research methodology is that we eventually adopt. And there are lots of different reasons why those sorts of, accommodations have to be made. And please don't be worried if you find that with your own research you're coming across the necessity to go for a plan B or to make a compromise or an accommodation. Okay, we've very nearly reached 3 o'clock, so I'm going to stop the tape now. I'm aware that...